10. Beating the system versus opting out. I no longer believed in Chinese morality. I'd been thinking in a way dictated to me by my parents and teachers, but it's not the only way. It's definitely not the right way. Amanda. I got the phone call on a Tuesday in January. Is your son in the middle class grade? Said the voice, crackling with assuredness. It was the admissions office at the International Kindergarten, where I'd submitted an application more than a year earlier. Yes, my son turned 5 this year, I responded, and suddenly found myself dancing a little jig. A spot has opened up for him, the voice said. We will hold it for 3 days. If we don't hear from you, we'll move on to the next child. Shanghai Victoria was tucked into a lane, down a peaceful, tree-lined street just a few blocks from home. There was no blaring bullhorn or growling guard. The principal met with parents regularly. Classes were taught in both Mandarin and English, which meant teachers were hired from both sides of the Pacific Ocean, and I found comforting the thought of a native English-speaking, Western-educated teacher inside my son's classroom. It was a popular school, a magnet for foreigners as well as elite Chinese who wanted something kinder and gentler than the local Chinese option. The school's marketing department knew this, and it was as smug as its waiting list was long. We have an innovative learning and teaching style that helps children reach their full potential, the school's brochures trumpeted. A Victoria parent I'd met was similarly self-assured. Classrooms are child-led, and the learning style is inquiry-based, she told me, drawing out the word child as if it were a strip of candied taffy that stretched and flattened without breaking in two. If a child has an interest in something, anything, they can broach it in class, and the class talks about it. Child-centered, she repeated. Not like what they do in Chinese school, she told me. Victoria was as close to a Western-style education as we would get, and it was our escape hatch from Chinese education. For some reason, Rob and I hesitated. Overall, has Chinese school been good for Rainey? I wondered out loud.
I think so, Rob said, a pinched look suddenly crossing his face.
The Chinese way has been good in at least one aspect.
When I grow up, you're going to be old,
Rainey said as he crawled into bed with us one morning. We three stared up at the ceiling, blinking the sleep from our eyes. That's right, I said, laughing.
Who will take care of you?
Rainey asked, turning sideways to look at me.
Funny you should ask, Rainey, I responded, laughing.
How about me?
My son said in a sing-songy voice. He'd absorbed a little Chinese-style filial piety, and I liked imagining that he'd never deign to let me spend a day in a nursing home. We had 3 days to figure out what we wanted to do. 3 days was Shanghai Victoria's upper limit for indecisive parents, and I pondered Rainey's educational future in a last desperate effort to discern how he was doing at this juncture. I still hadn't detected any worrisome behaviors, and I'd actually noticed a development I felt good about: critical thinking skills. Last month, Rainey had come to a frank realization about the Chinese teachers who control his environment.
Sometimes my teachers tell lies.
I'd discovered Rainey's enlightenment during one of our bedtime pillow talks.
Are you sometimes bad at work?
Rainey had asked me that evening as we lay side by side in his bottom bunk, staring up at the wooden slats overhead. Well, sometimes I don't feel like doing something, and I don't do it right, I responded.
What does your teacher say?
Rainey asked, looking small with his brown-haired head peeking out from underneath the covers. I have a boss. My boss will say, do it over again and fix it, I answered. Rainey stared up at the bottom of the top bunk, and I continued gently. What does your teacher do when you're bad? But Rainey didn't respond. I won't be mad at you, Rainey, I said. Please talk to me. My son's words came out tentatively at first.
Sometimes the teachers tell me I have to stay in the classroom,
and everyone else goes downstairs to play, he said, gazing at the top bunk. Sometimes they take me to look at the lower class grades, and they say they'll put me here, and I'll never see my classmates again.
My pulse quickened. Who else is with you when the teachers say that? I asked.
Last time, Li Fa Rong and Mei Mei and Wei Wei, he said, naming three other students. They cry, but I don't cry.
Rainey described their crying as thick, jolting sobs that rollicked throughout their bodies as if they were abandoned tiger cubs. Why do they cry? I asked.
Li Fa Rong believes that we'll never get to see our classmates again. But I know the teachers are faking it. I tell my classmates, it's jiade, fake.
Rainey said, flatly, with little emotion.
You know it's fake?
I exclaimed, glancing over at him.
Yes, I know. I know they're lying,
Rainey said, energized by my interest.
They also say I'll never see mommy again, but I know they're lying too.
Rainey seemed particularly assured by this statement. After all, I am here, aren't I? Most Chinese I know have a relationship with truth that's slightly different from my own. The Chinese are more likely to sacrifice the truth for a number of reasons, whether it's to pursue a goal, to protect the pride of an authority figure, to project modesty, or to preserve harmony. Studies comparing Chinese and Western culture back up this idea. Chinese doctors are less likely to tell a cancer patient the truth about a diagnosis, while Western doctors are more apt to reveal a grim prognosis. Chinese students look more positively upon a fellow classmate who told a small lie and more negatively upon one who told a truth that is boastful. A Chinese friend was told by her parents, "I found you in the garbage," to avoid having a frank talk about sex and procreation. In other words, the truth is not a worthy goal in and of itself, in part because the Chinese emphasize community over the needs of the individual. In the case of Rainey's teachers, the women were bending the truth in pursuit of a goal that was good for the collective. Children who behaved. I knew somewhere, deep inside, that I should have been outraged. But I wasn't. I think I'd long ago realized the futility of anger about something that had happened in the past. Or, perhaps, I'd become inured to the extremes of the Chinese system, since my overriding feeling was one of celebration and relief that Rainey had recognized the threat as fake. He was questioning. Whether this was due to his home environment or a quality of his personality, I didn't care. I simply wanted to celebrate. My son was thinking critically about his environment. The tunnel of information between us was rarely this open, and I pressed as Rainey continued to stare up at the slats of the upper bunk. I gathered that Li Fa Rong, the king of the naughty kids, had been punished by isolation at least half a dozen times this year. Rainey had been sent away only twice, for infractions that included goofing around during lunchtime. Do you like school, Rainey? I asked.
I like school, but sometimes I'd rather be at home with you, he answered.
Most days after pickup, he would run ahead of me, hand in hand with his classmates as they spilled out onto Big Green. He'd clamber over the playground equipment as I chatted with fellow parents and grandparents before we headed home. Rainey liked his friends, and I was also starting to find cohorts among the parents. That's normal, Rainey, I said. I like work just fine, but most of the time I'd rather be home with you. As we lay there, a peculiar feeling moved into my chest, a swirling mix of uncertainty and guilt and love. It overwhelmed me, and a few tears emerged in the corners of my eyes. You know, Rainey, I started. Sometimes, many times, I don't agree with how the teachers do things.
Okay,
he said.
But you have to remember, Mommy and Daddy love you for exactly who you are. We want you to feel like you can tell us anything.
Okay,
Rainey responded. We lay there for a beat.
Now what?
He asked, looking over at me. What do you mean? I said.
Should we go to sleep now?
Rainey said. Okay, I said, laughing, rubbing the tears from my eyes. Let's go to sleep.
With that, my little boy turned to face the wall and his head relaxed into his pillow. I watched as he dozed off, his chest expanding with each intake of breath, and I found that my own breathing began to match the rhythm of his. He'd been a comfort to the sobbing king of the naughty kids, and he'd also become a comfort to me.
While Rainey was well into his journey of tiny adjustments, my aspiring communist friend Darcy was showing mastery of the system.
I had an interview at Jiao Tong University, Darcy told me at our next meeting, naming one of China's top four colleges.
An interview? I asked Darcy. I thought everything was decided by Gaokao, by testing.
He grinned, gelled bangs bouncing as his head bobbed.
Some students have another way in.
The ministry was continuing to experiment with quality education and other reforms, and partly that meant chipping away at the importance of Gaokao for certain groups of students. Make exams less important, the theory goes, and childhood becomes a little more palatable. Jiao Tong University was one of about 70 colleges allowed to participate in independent recruitment that year, and the university had invited hundreds of students from all over China to interview. Students who passed the interview may be awarded bonus Gaokao points, or be allowed to score at a lower threshold than normally required for admission.
I looked over at Darcy. You were invited to interview?
Yes, Darcy said.
Who chose you?
My school principal. I'm the only one representing my school. I'm Qiji Fenzi, an enthusiast. They like me.
He grinned again. Qiji Fenzi literally meant fanatic and opportunist, all rolled up into one. It wasn't necessarily a positive term, and in using it, Darcy was giving a nod to his own duplicity. But he was a youth league member favored by school administrators. Darcy was well on the way toward accomplishing his goal, and in a Chinese student's life, the end often justifies the means.
What did you talk about in the interview? I asked him.
He glanced down for a brief moment, shyly, before looking up again.
I told them about you, he said. I told them I was learning a lot about the Western way of thinking.
I wasn't bothered.
We each had our reasons for befriending the other. Darcy sat before the Jiao Tong professors, who had asked him to describe memorable moments and people in his lifetime. Darcy's carefully scripted answers revealed an accomplished young man who also had an understanding of humility and group welfare. It was textbook communist humble brag. Besides talking about his new foreign friend, he'd told the professors he revered the computer genius Alan Turing, but that, I'm too modest to have similar ambitions. He'd gifted his mother a watch on Mother's Day, but it was purchased through barter, not cash. He'd rebutted his uncle, who'd lamented that China's standing in the world was tai ruo, or very weak, by insisting that China's efforts to protect the country's interests and encourage growth are impressive indeed.
I looked into the eyes of my Qiji Fenzi friend. Were you nervous? I asked him.
It wasn't difficult, Darcy said. I answered some questions based on the truth, and others based on what I thought they wanted to hear.
This reminded me of his bone marrow story. Last year, administrators at Darcy's high school mandated that students should give blood for bone marrow typing when they turned 18. Administrators earned fame and recognition from government elders for creating a registry, at the time a novelty for a public school. But a handful of students rebelled. They were angry that their bodies were being used for public show.
Darcy thought the protests were silly. For me, it's a must to be typed, because I will eventually join the party. The school won't think I'm good if I don't participate.
For Darcy, working inside the system would yield the best individual result. So he rolled up his sleeve for the nurse, and he didn't flinch when the needle slipped under his skin. Unlike Darcy, Amanda didn't care to rationalize anything. She wanted out of the system.
I feel I have shackles on, Amanda told me. I feel like I'm not allowed to think for myself.
Can you be more specific?
I asked. Amanda thought for a moment before nodding.
The Merchant of Venice, she said.
Amanda had studied Shakespeare's play in classrooms in both China and America. In it, the merchant Antonio borrows a large sum of money from the rich Jewish moneylender Shylock, seeking to help a friend in need. Unfortunately, the merchant's ships don't return from sea, and when the loan comes due, he doesn't have the money to pay. Shylock then demands a pound of flesh from the merchant per a contract clause, which is no simple matter. In 16th century Venice, the surgeon's knife would take the merchant's life. The action was straightforward. For Amanda, the drama came in the interpretations.
Boy, were there differences, Amanda told me.
The Chinese verdict on the flesh-demanding Shylock is clear. The Jewish moneylender is the evil incarnate, greedy and cruel. The teacher always presented Shylock as a heartless and merciless capitalist, Amanda says. Sitting in uniform inside her Shanghai classroom, Amanda never questioned this interpretation. She couldn't present evidence to the contrary, even if she'd wanted to. In China, works of literature are presented only in snippets or even rewritten, then carefully selected for its message and pasted into a textbook. Amanda's enlightenment had come in America, during her junior year abroad. There, she was assigned to read the full, unabridged version of the play. Immediately, she teased out the bigger picture. Shylock's peers ostracized and provoked him, a fact neatly excised from the Chinese textbooks.
Shylock's behavior is repulsive, but everyone in society rejected him. Society created the hateful Jew, Amanda exclaimed, still astounded by this revelation a year after she'd stumbled upon it. He's not the only party that is in the wrong.
Inspired, Amanda promptly penned a high school thesis on how evil characters are partly shaped by the environment in which they live. Most classrooms in America will include at least some discussion of this sympathetic approach to Shylock. You could not have presented this viewpoint in school in China? I asked her.
No, Amanda said.
Why not?
It deviates from the official interpretation.
Well, then how would you discuss themes in the play? I asked.
Discuss?
Amanda asked. Discuss. Debate in class. Talk about the different points of view, I said. Amanda chuckled, a quick laugh that emanated from her belly. It was the first truly spontaneous expression I'd seen from her, and it was prompted by my naivete.
There's no discussion, she said. The teacher would just read an excerpt from the play line by line, tell us what each phrase means and what we're supposed to memorize for tests.
What about essays? I asked. Could you present your ideas in writing?
Amanda shook her head. There's no point in an alternative way of thinking. To get credit on any test, you have to write the official answer.
What's the official interpretation of Shylock?
That Shylock's evil comes from the lust for money, and lusting after money is bad, Amanda said.
This made sense. The official party line trumpets that money is acquired only for individual pursuits. The good Chinese puts country, community, and society before self, and the party still held fast to that propaganda, despite the rampant capitalism and pursuit of money the Chinese witness all around them. For Amanda, going to America had been like ripping the door off her birdcage. After she returned to Shanghai, armed with a penchant for caffeine and the indelible experience of a year in a U.S. high school, she couldn't stop thinking about the lightness she'd experienced in the United States from being able to walk from math to English or from gym to world history at the bell. In China, students sit with the same classmates in a single room all day long for 6 years in primary and 3 years each in middle and high school. Only the teacher at the front changes. America gave her a freedom to be different, and a certain liberty came from changing the faces around her every hour. There were also Kant and Schopenhauer, which she could read in all their unabridged glory. Amanda had tested a couple years ahead of her American classmates in math, so she could opt out of core classes that she found easy, she told me. It was a statement free of arrogance. It was simply fact. She spent her newfound free hours immersed in Western philosophy. Nietzsche, Hume, Camus, Sartre.
I no longer believed in Chinese morality, she told me. I'd been thinking in a way dictated to me by my parents and teachers, but it's not the only way, and it's definitely not the right way.
The Chinese classroom began feeling like a chamber of stagnation, with the walls closing in on her, inch by inch. Amanda began getting into trouble with her teachers. Once back in Shanghai, Amanda was assigned to write an essay about the topic, the unknown. She let her thoughts flow and her pen move freely, and out sprang the idea that people should respect what they don't know.
I also wrote that people should challenge authority, Amanda told me.
It was her alternative worldview making its grand entrance in her Shanghai classroom. In China, the teacher crisscrossed her essay with red pen and scrawled a flunking grade across the top. A classmate adopted a system-approved template and received praise for words that shine, as the teacher put it, which deepened Amanda's humiliation.
My classmate wrote beautiful sentences but empty sentiments, and she didn't challenge anything, Amanda told me.
The Chinese judge good writing on emotional exaggerations and richness of language. By contrast, the American essay is valued more for stark language and clarity of argument. The experience was painful, but formative.
I was really, really sad after that, Amanda said.
The Chinese worldview no longer settled into her bones, and instead sat on top of her skin like an ill-fitting uniform. So, Amanda set her eyes on a new test. The SAT would lead her out of China, and, if all went according to plan, into an American university. She'd had a taste, and she was all too keen to join a small but steady procession of Chinese marching out of the education system they'd been born into.
As human beings, Amanda told me, we have a psychological need to give our lives some meaning.
For every handful of Darcy's rationalizing his place in the system, there was an Amanda scrabbling to get out. Every child is born with an imagination. It's this innate faculty that enables the process of creativity, which in turn gives rise to works of art, musical compositions, game-changing inventions, medical breakthroughs, new industries, or any novel or original approach that also has value. As a toddler, Rainey would dig for snails and root for stones, which he would scatter about in no discernible pattern as his giggles emanated across the lawn of our Shanghai complex. I reveled in watching him make discoveries. As Rainey's journey in Chinese school continued, the days of snail digging and stone throwing shriveled into a distant memory, and I grew more and more anxious that his environment might quash this innate quality of curiosity and exploration. Does Chinese school destroy creative and independent thinking abilities? Or does it only temporarily discourage their expression? What are Chinese graduates like later in life, in high school, in college, and after they enter the workforce? Mei Li teaches courses on innovation and entrepreneurship to Chinese university students in Shanghai, and she likes to try an exercise early on in a new class. The Chinese-American instructor will invite 10 students, all graduates of the Chinese school system, up to the front of the class. She gives each a paper bag and asks them to put the sacks over their heads. Then I ask them to take 1 minute to remove something they don't need, Li says. Blinded by a sack and standing before a hall of their peers, most Chinese students proceed to remove a watch, a shoe, or a coat. Others might take off their glasses underneath the bag, a piece of jewelry, or a sock. Meanwhile, their classmates in the audience are hooting with laughter, themselves unsure of anything but the humor in the spectacle. After the minute is up, Li will ask the students to remove the bags. And they do, standing at the head of the class, blinking under the lights of the room. I'll ask them, "Why didn't you take the bag off your head?" Mei Li says. And they'll look horrified, because it had never crossed their minds. There's an aha moment. Mei Li had conducted this exercise with thousands of Chinese students. By her estimate, only 3 of every 100 Chinese throw off the paper bag. Most students didn't have the mindset to recognize much less challenge their basic assumption, she says. The teacher told them to put a bag on their heads, and therefore its removal was off limits. Maylee didn't offer a control group, and the exercise itself could be considered something of a trick. Still, it got me thinking. Would a teenage Rainey remove the bag from his head? As concerned as I was about my own child, China's leadership was, too, about the students coming out of its schools. Creative and independent thinking skills are crucial to participating in the global economy, and many an economic expert says China risks stagnating as a second-rate world power if it cannot reform its schools and workplaces accordingly. The same series of global tests that gave Shanghai students top honors in math, reading, and science also found their performance slipped when it came to creative problem solving. Could China ever produce a Steve Jobs? Is a lament that surfs the wave of many a Chinese conscience. How much money have the foreigners made from us because they have better technology? A Chinese manufacturing executive bemoaned on national television in 2015 about China's failure to develop homegrown technology to produce ballpoint pen tips. Triumphantly, a state-owned steel manufacturer declared in early 2017 it had precision-engineered the solution. What did this all mean for my family? As I pored over research reports and talked to innovation experts, I discovered something sobering for Rainey's situation. The process of creativity cannot be separated from its social and cultural context. And, in fact, a person's environment is more important than heredity in influencing creativity, as researcher Lauren K. Statz wrote. A child's creativity can be either strongly encouraged or discouraged by early experiences at home and in school. I was also interested to learn that practicing being creative is critical to the process of creativity, ideally inside a setting that encourages its expression. Other academics purport that new experiences and a richness of stimuli are just as important to a child's mental development as good nutrition is to her physical growth, and that curiosity is a fragile thing. Obstacles to the creative process litter the Chinese education landscape. Domineering teachers who discourage open questioning. Exam metrics that keep children studying rather than exploring. Social collectivism that promotes conformity. Little time to practice being creative. And Confucianism's impact on the culture. In fact, the philosopher's very tenets discourage the openness, opportunity, and cooperation that is necessary to continue to release creativity in China, writes Stats. A British professor who teaches law in China told me, by the time the Chinese students get to me, they're not raising their hands. They don't even know how to frame a question. Their exploratory period has come to an end. Furthermore, taking risks is punished inside Chinese education. My Shanghainese friend Ophelia learned her lesson very early on. Her first grade math teacher asked the class to practice tracing equal signs with two perfectly parallel strokes. At six, Ophelia had trouble, so she tied two pencils together with string. Voila! A single stroke yielded two perfect lines each time. Ophelia had taken a creative risk, but the teacher was livid. She tacked my paper to the front wall and shamed me in front of the entire class, said Ophelia. An American friend of Rainey's had a similar experience. While tracing out a turtle in class, Maya swerved to draw a little flipper before looping from number 18 to number 19. Deviant appendages have no place in a Chinese kindergarten, and the teacher slashed up her worksheet with fat, red strokes. At home, Maya cried to her mother, God wanted this turtle to have a foot, she said. Her mother thought for a moment and wisely replied, God may want this turtle to have a foot, but in the school, the teacher is God. So, in school, you draw the turtle from number 18 to number 19. The Chinese classroom encourages conformity and discourages experimentation, which can mean death for the creative process. The cultural fear of losing face, or mianzi, also rears its oppressive head. A Hangzhou high school principal surveyed his teenagers and found that most equated thinking outside the box with not respecting teachers. Such an environment can also percolate at home, My parents certainly could have fashioned a more open childhood environment, as nurturing creativity and independence didn't much enter their thoughts. Independent children were disobedient children, and art, literature, or writing classes didn't figure into my parents' exacting calculus of how I'd get into an elite university. When we traveled, we rarely visited museums or art galleries, and European philosophy had no seat at the dinner table. For my parents, scientists with 6 college and graduate degrees between them, artistry was found in the curve of the sine symbol, melody in the memorization of the digits of pi, and free expression in the liquid nitrogen beads that scampered across the floor at my mother's chemistry laboratory. The liberal arts figured into my mother's life prominently as a hobby. She pored over British classics as well as science fiction and fantasy, but such things weren't considered something worthy of class time or career pursuit. When it came to subjects that piqued my interest, my parents had their own ideas, rooted in the practicality of the job market. "I want to study psychology," I announced during my sophomore year in college. I'd heard a fascinating lecture by the psychologist Anne Fernald, and I was enthralled by the study of mind and behavior.
"What kind of job are you going to get with a psychology degree?"
my father replied. "Well, how about sociology? Sociology is interesting too," I responded.
"And where will sociology lead?" he rebutted.
A month later, I thought I'd found the perfect solution.
IE, industrial engineering,
I declared via telephone, naively triumphant. It was a field with enough study of human behavior to capture my interest, and plenty of math and hard science to placate my parents.
"We chemical engineers joke that IE stands for imaginary engineering," my father replied.
He'd fashioned exactly the type of environment to win that particular battle, and I spent many units at Stanford learning to design spillways for dams and calculate loads on truss bridges. I graduated with a bachelor's degree in civil and environmental engineering. My Chinese and Chinese-American friends who became sociologists, artists, and writers tell me that they had home environments that were nurturing and open, they said, which worked to negate the impact of school. Or, like me, they found their path only later in life. Unfortunately, many students who end up at China's top-tier schools are skilled at following a well-defined pathway to success, which means many of the country's best first-year students haven't yet failed at anything, though this probably holds true at top universities worldwide. In fact, some of China's highest-profile personalities insist they were successful because they had a third-rate, rather than a top-tier, Chinese education. Jack Ma, the billionaire founder of Alibaba, failed the Gaokao 3 times and credits his inferior college education with his entrepreneurial success today.
"If I'd gone to Tsinghua or Peking University, I might be a researcher today," he'd said in a speech. "Because I went to Hangzhou Normal University, I got my cultural education by having fun. Kids who know how to have fun, are able to have fun, and want to have fun generally have bright futures."
Han Han is one of China's most popular bloggers. He's also a high school dropout. In a newspaper article that was reposted many times, Han Han likened Chinese education to
standing in a shower wearing a padded coat. The very likely result of performing at full development in Chinese education is fully mediocre.
But is the Chinese education system all bleakness? The creative spirit of the Chinese, while it may not always be on display inside the classroom, is buzzing inside China's marketplace, insist friends and colleagues who work in China. After years of oppression and decades of restrictive economic policies, the Chinese have been raring for opportunities to build a better life for themselves and their families, and even the tiniest bit of encouragement can unleash the floodgates of creative activity. The proof is a spirit that thrives in public chat rooms and inside startups, spurred by government policy that boosts venture capital funds and provides incentives to entrepreneurs. Out of the buzzing swamps of the Chinese tech world has emerged Tencent, which owns the WeChat messaging platform, and Alibaba, one of the most watched companies in the world. And when highly skilled Chinese migrate overseas, the results can be impressive. Researchers studying entrepreneurship discovered that Chinese or Taiwanese immigrants founded 13% of Silicon Valley startups and contributed to 17% of America's global patents, at a ratio disproportionate to their percentage in the general population. I'm a product of American culture, and like my fellow Westerners, I romanticized the concept of a lone, eccentric genius in the model of Steve Wozniak or Steve Jobs, who invented the personal computer inside a garage or went on to disrupt entire industries. Who wouldn't want their kid to retreat with a couple of circuit boards and emerge with the foundations of a product that would revolutionize the way we live or work? The Chinese way forward may be more interdependent and group-oriented at the moment, and change can be more incremental than earth-shattering all at once. Consider that Chinese painters are taught to model early work after a famous painter, and copy it over and over until the techniques are ingrained in the muscle memory. Once the basic skills are mastered, true creation begins. The Chinese companies considered most revolutionary today arguably took someone else's model, made incremental improvements, and eventually became uniquely Chinese. Is that not innovation, defined through a non-Western lens? For now, this works. As a professor of entrepreneurship told me, if a Steve Jobs-like visionary is truly what China seeks, it needs only one. In truth, there aren't many Steves in the West either. A for-profit education executive told me that as much as Westerners, and many Chinese themselves, denigrate the authoritarianism in China's social, political, and education systems, it might actually prompt risk-taking. Though it also clearly promotes breaking the law. The Chinese are used to navigating brick walls. You build a wall, and they will have figured out how to get around it even before the cement is dry. A tendency to shun planning may also encourage the experimentation that gives rise to innovation. Even cement in China is considered less permanent than it is in the West. Crews in China pour roads, only to have the cement chopped up 2 weeks later to install pipes. In this anecdote is a sense that anything is possible and the usual norms don't apply. Break, then pour again, and again, and again. A strength of the Chinese marketplace is that change happens quickly, at a pace and fashion astounding to most Westerners who work here. In this environment, perhaps individual creativity, so valued in the West, is trumped by determination and opportunity. If it's doggedness, the Chinese have that in spades, and willingness to try, fail, said an American investor friend who's worked in China for 15 years. Does this all mean that China can't produce a Steve Jobs? Or does it simply mean the type of revolutionary change will just look a little different? A Western education professor who's been coming in and out of China since 1983 told me, China's getting innovative and it's happening very, very fast. For those who work in China, there's a consensus that this no creativity argument is a fallacy. The classroom certainly poses barriers to expression, among other problems. To be fair, educators around the world are also concerned about this in their own schools. But the Chinese are working to overcome these obstacles. If it's not happening in school, opportunities might come in the workplace. Coaching and training are my top priorities, says a Chinese chief technology officer in Shanghai who has worked with thousands of young Chinese programmers and engineers. It's my job to unwrap the chains. Some of them are extremely quick studies, and they become the cream of the crop. Indeed, at its most effective, creativity and outside-the-box thinking require a solid foundation of technical skills and discipline, which holds true whether you're a painter, writer, or tech entrepreneur. When I think about Rainey's education in China, I know he'll come out with a strong foundation in math, science, and other academic disciplines. Ideally, he'll also have all those wonderful soft skills and an education in the humanities, which we may have to work on later. If the school environment emphasizes one side of this equation, as Chinese school often does, the other must be encouraged at home or outside the schoolroom. I wanted my son to be conversant on all sides of the equation. Rainey was making huge leaps in the areas that we liked about the Chinese system. He was a disciplined and polite child, and he was making progress with numbers, with more to come in primary school.
Rainey's got a pretty amazing sense of self-control now, Rob said on the second day of Operation Decision Opt-Out.
Yes, but have you ever seen him color? I said. He just can't seem to draw outside the lines, and he keeps drawing dinosaurs over and over again, repeatedly.
Though some days I'd fret about Chinese education, and other times Rob would take a turn.
That's not true at all, Rob said. Rainey draws all kinds of things. And we're making sure he's getting opportunities to be creative at home.
What about blind obedience? I asked.
Rob laughed.
Does he seem like a weak-willed child?
Just that morning, Rainey had emerged at breakfast in an outfit he'd chosen himself. His brown corduroys clashed with his blue and white striped shirt, and I was bothered by his sartorial choices.
Morning, Rainey. Can you change your pants? I asked as I went to the kitchen to deposit my coffee mug. You don't match.
No,
he responded, trailing me defiantly into the kitchen. Did you hear what I said? I said no. I won't go change my pants.
He planted himself in the doorway, holding my gaze. Rob and I rejoiced in this display of will.
See, Rob said. And yesterday he arranged all his dinosaurs in the form of an army to face off against his Star Wars characters. He called it Dinosaur Star Wars. How do you make Star Wars even cooler than it is? Throw in dinosaurs. How creative is that?
You're grasping, I told my husband. In truth, all seemed to be going fine. The longer a child stays in the Chinese system, I knew, the harder it might be to undo some of its more oppressive effects. And there might even be a point of no return for some Chinese children. But we simply weren't there yet. It's also possible Rainey is an outlier personality who might emerge from a Chinese environment with these qualities intact. Not only had Rainey figured out adults sometimes lie, cue in teacher Song's empty classroom threats, but by 4 years of age, he was already Santa sleuthing.
Are reindeers afraid of Santa?
He'd asked earlier in the winter. We'd been decorating a pine tree from Oregon. The Chinese had begun to adopt Christmas wholesale, though they were more likely to celebrate commercialism than the birth of Christ.
No, reindeer are not afraid of Santa, Rob responded.
Rainey thought for a long while, hanging a sleigh ornament on our tiny ocean container-shipped tree.
But deers are afraid of people, Rainey challenged. Does this mean Santa is not a person?
As I pondered all of this, Shanghai Victoria awaited our decision, and I considered some of the observations I'd collected along the way. Darcy once told me China's education system was not yet strong, and only if the trunk grows well can the flowers blossom. The need to nurture and develop China's education system made the day-to-day experience of the individual student inflexible, he insisted. The British-Chinese journalist Xinran gave her own analogy. China is very much like Picasso's paintings. We have eyes, a nose, lips, ears, but not in the right position. Yet, with time and patience, those branches were beginning to stretch, and those eyes and ears were starting to find their place. One day before I had to call the admissions officer at Shanghai Victoria, I embarked on one last gasp of an investigation. What happens when a child misbehaves? I asked a Shanghai Victoria teacher during a site visit I requested.
I don't believe in punishment, said the English teacher I met with. I just talked to them a little bit about what they did wrong.
Punishment wasn't all that Victoria teachers disavowed. They rejected the traditional Chinese curriculum and instead embraced a free-form option where discussions could be designed around any subject a child broached. Free play was built into the daily schedule. Math was taught in a toddler-friendly fashion that shunned rote and embraced using numbers in everyday life. Management actively sought out parents to ask where the school might improve. This all sounded great, but were there any potential problems?
Victoria's pretty good, but these parents concern themselves with things I don't care about, said my friend Alex, whose son attended the school.
A trained attorney and a PhD with a talent for languages, she has a penchant for cultural affairs and worldly matters and zero tolerance for bullshit. I'd always appreciated her opinion.
What do you mean? I asked.
These parents are entitled, Alex said.
Victoria parents hailed mostly from America, Europe, and Australia, and to me, they exemplified Western parenting. At Rainey's school, the parents work very hard to kowtow to the teacher, I told her.
Not at Victoria,
Alex warned me. I once got a look at some of the emails circulating in a parent group at the school. One mother of the Piglet class had a very distinct wish. I wondered if we can request class teachers give us simple live activity updates. A few pictures, video, etc. I'd always felt Western schools spent time catering to interests that have nothing to do with educating children. Not to mention, how could teachers teach if they were required to be daily documentary filmmakers?
But it was parental hubbub over the Victoria school's shoe rack policy that gave me the greatest pause.
Chinese streets sometimes double as repositories for spit and cigarette butts. And the school had a fix. Children must switch their street shoes for a clean, indoor pair each morning before entering campus. Before exiting at the end of the day, the children would again slip into their outdoor shoes, which had spent the day, germs and all, waiting on a shoe rack by the school entrance. It was a worthy goal, but administrators soon called foul. Teachers were spending too much time coaxing toddlers into and out of footwear. So the school changed the policy, without informing the parents. Piglet class parents were horrified and incensed, and they mobilized by email.
I'm absolutely not happy, tapped one.
The school did not notify the parents officially, said another.
And the attitude of the school is quite patronizing in a way.
One grassroots Western mom took a poll to gauge support, receiving 7 ayes. The mom intended to take this poll to the principal to enact change. Perhaps I'd been in China too long, but I was appalled. Teacher Song would never feel compelled to notify Song Qingling parents of anything she felt was strictly need to know, much less ask permission if the school wanted to do so much as remove a shoe rack by a door. Once upon a time, I might have imagined mobilizing a parent group, say, to banish forced egg eating or allow asthma inhalers to be kept near the classroom. I know now what would be in store for me. I'd have been exiled, if not physically, then socially. Other parents would whisper as I passed them on the big green. That's the mom who tried to introduce democracy at Song Qingling, they'd say, avoiding eye contact. Blaring Bullhorn, the principal who manned the gates with a speakerphone, would tell the security guards to shut the gates before I arrived. The Chinese way is to hire good administrators and trust them to do their jobs. Parents were to support the system, take responsibility for as much as possible, and keep petty distractions out of the equation. I didn't disagree. Deciding to stay at Song Qingling wasn't as much an intellectual decision as a gut feeling. I was growing more and more disenchanted with the system, especially with the political aspects of the classroom and the conundrum presented by gifting and favors. Yet the road out of Chinese education is strictly one way. It would be impossible to backtrack after that first step out, and I didn't feel it was the right time to go. Many of the academic benefits granted the Chinese way would come in primary school. And any teacher or parent knows it's much easier to begin strictly and travel toward leniency than the other way around. Thoughts swirling in my head, cheeks pressed against the iron bars, I stood outside the Song Qingling gates to observe morning exercises a few hours before Shanghai Victoria's deadline. 100 children were out on Big Green.
Line up!
Teacher Song called out to her charges, clapping twice, and her students filed into regiments alongside the 4 other classes of the middle grade. Morning exercises were usually a half hour of choreographed routines, performed in neat rows, which transformed Big Green into a field of tiny marching soldiers. Today, each child held a pair of plastic rings, and as the music began, I saw that Rainey was no willing participant when the music began. When children extended their rings toward the sun, Rainey's shot down toward his feet. When some splayed left and others flew right, Rainey's stretched skyward, lifted by the enthusiastic arms of an energetic little boy. When his classmates' bodies lurched toward the turf for the finale, Rainey's was a body in motion, hurtling across the courtyard to call on friends in middle class number 3. He skipped in the narrow alley between the lines, zigging from one end to another, like a water bug skimming the surface of a pond. Perhaps the teachers were making a concession for an overactive foreigner, or maybe their leniency was a taste of White Bible's kinder, gentler approach filtering into the school. Whatever the reason, I was comforted by his display of individuality.
Let's go!
Teacher Song barked as the music stopped, and the children filed into lines for the orderly walk toward the classroom. When the line began to move, Rainey leapt like a frog, hands jumping forward, feet following shortly thereafter. In this way, he hopscotched into the building until his white ankle socks fell out of view.
He was just running around and jumping, and no one was paying attention?
Rob asked later when I recounted the story. That's right, I'd said. I saw a little boy comfortable in his skin, I told Rob. We exchanged glances. In that pregnant pause, Rob and I sped through our thoughts, histories, backgrounds, how we'd arrived at this place in time. Rob had grown up in a Minnesotan town of 2,000 residents, with a lake that could be skated in winter and boated in summer, and teachers who were generally friendly and helpful. For his own children, he wanted exposure to a bit more culture, academic discipline, and rigor than he'd had growing up. I was recovering from a pressure-ridden suburban upbringing, but I'd never lost sight of the merits of academic rigor in the way that the Chinese delivered it. Rob and I comprised the perfect confluence of factors to choose a Chinese environment for our son. So we're staying, I said, giving voice to the conclusion we'd already reached independently.
We've already done the hard behavioral stuff, and he survived,
Rob said. Why leave before the academics begins? In the next year, we knew that teachers would begin exposing the class to basic math concepts and Chinese character learning. I shared news of our decision with my mother-in-law, Joanne, a career American public school teacher, and she wrote, After you make the decision, just know you did the best you could, and look for the good in whichever school you choose. What exactly was the good of Chinese education? I would suss this out for the next part of our journey. Rob glanced at me.
You know, we have to be okay with the fact that sometimes we'll doubt our decision, that we'll feel like outsiders, and that we won't always like the way they do things.
I grasped onto this thread. My bigger question is he generally happy in class? Is he confident? I think he is. We would observe closely and take it day by day, month by month, year by year. Rob looked at me intently, his eyes holding mine.
And let's not be so anxious.
Maybe we should relax more, Rob suggested, gently. That directive, I knew, was for me.